You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
For our first podcast episode about a podcast, we welcome award-winning writer of speculative fiction, Martha Wells, to discuss the mystery comedy series created by Steve Martin and John Hoffman, Only Murders in the Building. Recently renewed for a fifth season, the series features an intergenerational trio of Manhattan residents obsessed with true crime. Played by Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez, the hilarious trio become amateur sleuths, investigating murders committed in and around their building, which they share on a DIY podcast. Replete with meta self-referential jokes, cameo appearances, and regular guest stars, the cozy show has reinstated some faith in the human race during turbulent times.
Martha Wells has been a science fiction fantasy writer since her first fantasy novel was published in 1993. Her work includes the books of the Raxura series, the Il Rien series, the Murderbot Diaries series, and other fantasy novels, most recently Witch King, in 2023. She has also written media tie-in fiction for Star Wars, Stargate Atlantis, and Magic the Gathering, as well as short fiction, YA novels, and nonfiction. She has won Nebula Awards, Hugo Awards, Locus Awards, an Alex Award, and a Dragon Award. Her work has also appeared on the World Fantasy Award ballot, the Philip K. Dick Award ballot, the BSFA Award ballot, the USA Today bestseller list, the Sunday Times bestseller list, and the New York Times bestseller list. She is a member of the Texas Literary Hall of Fame, and her books have been published in 30 languages. She is also a consulting producer on the Murderbot series for Apple TV+. Hello, Martha Wells. Welcome to After Images podcast. We're delighted to have you here today to talk about Only Murders in the Building.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And we usually like to begin the podcast by simply asking why you suggested this series and what it has meant to you. I say what it has meant to you since it's ongoing and we can hope for more.
I suggested it because it's one of my favorites. And I think it's a series that rewards rewatching because it's fairly complex, especially as regards to characterization. And I really love shows like that. I'm really a big fan of mysteries too.
I was going to ask you if that's one of your favorite genres. And there's also this aspect of comedy that comes into this mystery. And it feels to me like the late 20th century really kicked off a strong tradition of that that's ongoing thanks to this series.
Yeah, I like mysteries that can combine, or any shows that can combine humor and yet not lose the kind of fundamental plots for their genre. Like the mysteries are actually good and hard to figure out. And it doesn't, and the humor doesn't really affect that part of the plot. It just enhances it.
Absolutely. And have you got a favorite season so far, one that you love to go back to and dig into?
Actually, I was rewatching it last weekend. And I think I was kind of debating between the second and third season, the Broadway show season, which I think is great. And I think that might be my favorite. When I was rewatching the fourth season, it's the fourth season, the one that just came out it came out, I guess, last year. At first I thought that started a little slow, and I think it was just because I was so impatient for them to find the body and start figuring out what had happened, and then realized, no, that's just one episode. It's pacing is just right, I think. But I really think three is my favorite just because of the whole Broadway and bringing the other characters into the, and making having the neighbor Jonathan, I think, more involved because he is fantastic. And there were parts of that that were just laugh out loud.
Wow. I'm so glad to hear you say that because that's my favorite season as well. I just think the writing is so strong. I mean, it's always strong, but I think there are some really standout moments in that season, and the kind of dual layers of what's happening on stage and behind the scenes, and the whole architecture of the theater is so great in that season.
Yeah, I really love the fact that, I mean, one of the things I really like about the series as a whole is it introduces characters and gives you a first impression of that character, the same kind of way you would meet a person. And then the more you see about that character, the more you learn about them. And sometimes it's surprising and sometimes it's not. And it just deepens. Oh, kitty. And it just deepens the your appreciation of it as it goes along, including even characters that are introduced as the bad guys and so forth. And I think the Broadway or season does that really well with the show itself because it sort of takes you a while to realize the first version of the play is just really stupid. It's like it's one of those, it comes across as one of those really old plays that somebody tried to get onto Broadway at some point and it just, ran for a couple of days and then failed because it just doesn't make any sense. Like, are they really, is there some sort of metaphor we're not getting that they think the baby did it? And that's so perfect. And then as they start the musical, it just seems worse at first. But then as you see more of the musical and the songs are actually quite good, especially when you finally see the run through with the orchestra, I think that's when it starts to dawn on you. This is taking something stupid and making it so much more stupid. It's becomes surreal and funny, and you can't take it seriously. And it's actually going to be really good.
And what's interesting, I think, in all of the seasons is that not only is it funny and not only is the plot interesting and interests you in the characters, but it is also very metatextual. I mean, it really talks about media themselves. It talks about podcasts, it talks about Broadway, it talks about television. There's another layer to that series, this series, isn't there?
Oh yeah, there definitely is. And I think in the latest season that comes out, when they talk about usually we don't figure that out until till like episode 4 or something. But, and it kind of like takes you out of the moment for a little bit and you realize, oh, they're talking about the podcast. And they're kind of doing both. But that was a season I thought that just got more and more interesting and more the build of it. As you watched it, became more and more complex and interesting over time, and really finally getting into Saz's character. And I'm glad they brought the actor back to do the, because usually it's Mabel, I think, that has the conversations with the murdered person, but having it be Charles was really interesting. And she's and everybody in the show is such a good actor, and it just really worked.
True. And since we've been talking about season three, I wondered if I could go back to something you said about the rhythm, this moment when we want to find a body or really go somewhere with the mystery. And that's such a big discussion today in mystery writing, isn't it? In terms of, I've heard editors say, I don't want any more first page bodies found, like right in the beginning, that shocks the audience. On the other hand, that can have quite an effect in terms of drawing us immediately into a mystery. So I'm just wondering, what do you think about finding that right moment, that right rhythm for writing in a mystery?
I think it just takes a lot of experience because it really depends to me on the story. And, the way you tell a story in TV is so different from the way you tell it in a prose novel or a graphic novel or anything else. And I think the fact that TV, it when you're watching it, I think it feels like things are happening in a longer time than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
Like a minute on TV seems to take up so much more like story space than a minute of reading a book. And so that's kind of a thing that I think that's part of why writing for TV script writing is so very different from novel writing. And I've been asked, why don't you just write scripts or something? And it's sort of like, because that's really hard and I don't know how to do it. I would have to basically relearn the way I write. And like people who move from prose novels or also write graphic novels or comics, it's a completely different way of writing. So yeah, the pacing, and I think it's because I cared more about Saz as a character, and I wanted them to get to that moment. And I think also it's because usually in the previous seasons, it's been immediate where they're the ones who find the body. And it happens usually because we already usually see that moment in the previous season in that kind of little trailer that goes into the next season. Like we see, well, we think we see in the Broadway season, we think we see Ben die on stage. We think we see, which was great that they changed that. I think that they're deliberately changing that up a little bit to kind of surprise you because, when he walks back into the party, it's just such a complete shock. And you're just rearranging your brain of what you already understand about the story and what's going to happen. And so moments like that really work are really cool. And right when you're like, okay, Ben's going to be alive, someone else is going to be killed, or maybe it's going to be about who's trying to poison Ben, and then Ben dies, and there's Ben's body, and it's just horrible. And particularly since it's, again, it's a very likable actor, and he comes across as a jerk. We first meet him, he's being a complete jerk, but as it goes along, we realize what's going on with him, and he's under these pressures, and he's actually not a bad person. He's just, cranky and upset and things like that. So yeah, I think the pacing works, and I think again the fact that they play with that moment of discovery is very kind of intrinsic to the show and the way it likes to play with how it introduces information to you and how it introduces character and makes you think about the characters and then does things that changes your mind.
I have the feeling that there's a lot about time that is so important in this TV series. I mean, because of the plot itself, because of the past of the characters, because elements, as you mentioned, we don't have the information until later, and we are trying to put the pieces together. And also because of the age of the main characters. I mean, we have two older people, and this is very different compared to mainstream television today or to filmmaking, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very different. They've had a lot of experience and they have a lot of they've made a lot of their mistakes and they do know a lot of things. But then I love the way they one of the running jokes is how they're in their not very involved with modern technology in some respects. Like, oh gosh, it was Oliver's giant iPad. And Mabel has a line, I don't think I've ever seen Instagram that big. And it's like, yeah, that's what older people do. You can't see the tiny screen. You can put it on your iPad where you can see it. But all those things. And the fact that they have, when they're first introduced, when Charles and Oliver are first introduced, we're sort of, again, we don't quite trust them. Because again, they're considered suspects too, as far as the viewer is concerned, because of these things we see. But we also, don't think of them as very competent because we've got two comedians playing these roles who have, really excelled at those kind of characters. So we don't think of them as too competent. And as they go along, we see they are. I mean, they have their foibles. But I think especially in season two, where Charles does that game, not Charles, I'm sorry, Oliver does that game, the with the God, what's it called? The Night Stalker,
Oh,
the murder card game.
yeah.
And he's using it as a way to kind of evaluate people and see how good a liar they are and if they're concealing things, what they look like when they're concealing things. And that's so interesting. I think that's one moment where we really, and then we find out later he was right. That he wasn't mistaken. He was actually right about her. And then we find the moment when Oliver goes in and helps his son with the play he's trying to do with the kids. And Oliver knows exactly how to handle all these kids, and he's handled actors for years of all different ages. He knows exactly what to do. And so it's like those moments of seeing the characters be competent and in their jobs and the things they know. When we find out Charles did this that song that they keep playing, I think he has it as a ringtone at one point. Something about the girl in sandals and the album he did. And you find out he makes $100,000 a year off that song because it's been sampled so many. And it's just those moments, it's like it that the whole show is really got these shifting moments of changing your view of the characters so much. And I think that's one of the things that I love the most about it.
And there's also that element about blurring the line between fiction and reality, because the characters of Charles and Oliver, they also bring all the baggage of their former roles or their former acting to their characters, don't they?
And they play with that. And there was a scene in oh gosh, yeah, season four. Just it well it always like hits you over all over again what a great physical actor Steve Martin is, and how funny they both are. And yeah, they play with that. It is, like you said, it's very meta. It's like the viewer knows they're watching a show and they know they're making a show, and so they play with every aspect of that.
And I feel like the timing of the show, the fact that it dropped in 2021, was such a comfort during a very difficult time to have familiar faces that, I've grown up watching Martin Short and Steve Martin and watch them metamorphose from one comedic character to the other. And that was just a tremendous sense of relief to really sink into this mystery during the pandemic.
I really think it was too. It was one of those really great just it was a great comfort, when it came on. And yeah, these comedians you're familiar with, and just it's such a show that's also so loving to its characters in a way. It doesn't treat people as throwaway. It's like everybody has a reason for what they're doing. Everybody has an issue or a trauma they're struggling with. Even and they do that after season, especially in season two. I think you get used to the idea that that's going to be nobody's one dimensional. Everybody has this background that they're struggling with, and even Jan. In some ways, in season four, they really highlight how really competent Jan is at what she does. And it's terrifying when she's got that line at the end of something like, Charles, you and I are in game, you know it. And you're just like, oh God, no, please. And yeah, it was one of those things that came out during I guess that was the second year of the pandemic when, it was just, I mean, I paid, it was on, it's on Hulu over here, and I paid for Hulu to be able to see it without commercials, because it's like I heard it was really good, and then I started watching. It's like, oh yeah, I need this without commercials.
And to keep going with this meta theme, I also love the kind of intergenerational SNL Saturday Night Live characters that we get that do various guest starring roles or cameos. Do you have any favorite cameos or guest stars in the series?
Matthew Broderick was really unexpected. and cool in this past season. I'm trying to think of earlier seasons. Gosh, what's her name? Who played the other podcast reporter?
Tina Fey.
Tina Fey, she's really brilliant. I really love seeing her. I loved her in the recent Perreault movie, Haunting in Venice. She was fabulous in that.
And unexpected too. I don't think she's had a chance to really show her range, and that was really good.
Yeah, and she was doing that the Atlantic accent. I think that was, yeah, had that perfectly down, and it just really just that's one of my favorite movies, I think, especially around Halloween. But yeah, so she was my other favorite. But yeah, there's just it's so funny when someone pops up who's so unexpected. Oh, for example, the reviewer in the Broadway season is actually played by Noma Dumezweni, who's in Murderbot, the Murderbot series. So that was kind of cool to see.
Very nice. And have you visited the set of Murderbot? Were you able to meet her?
Yeah, we were able to visit once. I could only go up there once because I was finishing my a fantasy novel, and I needed to get. I was really behind because I had a bunch of medical issues in the previous year, and it really slowed me down. So I was finishing up that, and so I could only get up there for one day on the set. But yeah, I got to meet everybody, and it was really fabulous.
Fantastic.
And I guess that the question that's on every lips is, will Murderbot make a guest appearance in the fifth season of Only Murders in the Building?
That would be cool. That would be really cool to see.
To come back to what you were saying, you were talking about the multidimensionality of the characters, the fact that there are several layers to themselves. And there's one character that we haven't mentioned yet, and who is extremely important. It's the Arconia, isn't it? It's central to the show.
And it's really interesting the way that we see it through Mabel's eyes and Charles's eyes, basically. As to Charles, it's just very homey. It's his little sanctuary, and Mabel sees it, I think, as a lot more fraught, particularly where since she doesn't own that apartment. She's just, kind of there first, helping her aunt, and then later on and in season four we finally get to see her get her own apartment. But yeah, it's such a character in this and there's still people we've glimpsed as other neighbors that we don't know very much about, but they sort of set up a little foundation for, so you always wonder if they're going to become important later.
Yes. And it has layers, hasn't it? I mean, it's got like hidden passageways, and it's like a.
Yeah, that was really cool when they added the hidden passageways, and it sort of did. And there's always a feeling like you don't know everything yet, and particularly in this last season where they talk about the things that weren't explained from the first season, and where you were supposed to assume that Jan did them, but maybe not. And you don't really, and it, and then again, the note that was actually left for Jan is like, did she do that? And it's interesting that they don't. I realized again when I watched it again, because I was thinking, did they say that group that the Ohel, the group that plays Ohel, and did they do those things? And they didn't really mention that at all, because it's like they mentioned being afraid about the podcast that they would discover what they'd done, but they don't mention any attempt to, and they don't really seem like they would poison the dog or, and even with a poison that it survives. And yeah, so it's kind of like I'm wondering if that will kind of be, because usually 5 seasons is kind of a good number for a lot of shows. So I kind of wonder if they're planning like for the fifth season to be the last one, and they'll be do a big thing there where the stuff has been going on all along.
That would be fun. And I feel like the opening credits set that up really well, don't they? In terms of the way that we move from one window to the next. And, we're limited in what we see through the window as an outside observer. But at the same time, we get the feeling that there's just so much going on in this building and that there could be all sorts of things happening between those windows, the walls blocking us and what we don't see. I just find that really simple but effective in terms of opening credits and
Oh yeah, definitely. And the way it pulls back and the figures watching it and just yeah, it really does get that across.
I really had the feeling there was something of Rear Window there, perhaps a tribute.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. And then yeah, and since we now have the they've talked about the Westies, the people on the other side, where they're kind of like looking at each other through the windows and seeing stuff happen and adding this whole dimension. And I love that they can do that where their world is so developed, they add a dimension to it and it just feels like it's been there all along. Like meeting Charles's sister and when they go out there to try to get away, try to escape.
Yeah. They've just been so great about kind of changing things up, as you mentioned, and always bringing in new people, new situations. I felt like the theater season really took us briefly out of the building so that we could get a fresh environment and then come back to the building again like an old friend. But I agree with you with 5 seasons, I'm wondering, okay, so far they've kept it really fresh and good. But after season 5, do you feel like there are ways that they could go, or do you feel like you might like to see it come to a good ending?
I think there are ways they can go because the whole thing with the way they develop characters and the way they do their story arcs is it's not like an arc with an ending. It's more like they're building outward continuously. And there's always things to discover about these people, just like there's always things to discover about real people. So I think it is. They can, and the fact that they're quite really well able to develop whole new sections of the building that they're able to introduce, and we assume that was there all along because they've grounded us so in their world.
And what do you think? I mean, let's come back to the very origin of the show itself about the use of the podcast. Well, what is it about the podcast that's so important? I mean, this is an episode of a podcast about a show about a podcast, so it is also.
Yes.
But what is it about the podcast I don't know, a news form as the practice that brings something to the show, according to you?
I think that it's just really interesting since, and it does fit so well with it being basically a pandemic story, which is what people, in writing, a lot of people talk about this book was my pandemic book and so forth, because this was the one that you created in that first year of adjusting to basically what's a whole new world. And I think it has that feel where podcasts were really coming into their own. And podcasts do true crime podcasts in particular, because true crime has always been popular. And when it's done well, it's incredibly fascinating to break apart these cases and see and try to figure out what really happened, particularly ones that are still unsolved, that there's a lot of information about. And so the fact that they would bond over a true crime podcast was really it was a good hook, because it's like, what are these three people who are fairly different, especially Mabel seems very different, what is going to spark their friendship? And that's a thing that can do it if they're all three interested in it and they all three know a lot about it. And also, what is going to keep them together is doing that kind of thing. And again, I think that also goes into the meta-ness of it, is the characters are making a show. And it kind of reminded me a bit of Staged by Michael Sheen and David Tennant, which I didn't get to see during the pandemic. I think I heard a little bit about it, but didn't know it. And I didn't know to go look for it. And I didn't see it until it came on one of the streaming channels. And its first season is very rooted in the pandemic of David Tennant has a line about being helpless to help, that they're actors, they're entertainers, and their whole job is to tell stories, and they're just stymied in their way that they can do it, and they're just and it's killing them. And being able to make that show is obviously what their solution to that and to make staged. And then you find out, and I really found out David Tennant actually did have a podcast where he, like a lot of other actors did, where they just interview each other and interview their friends, and how helpful those things were to people who really needed connection and entertainment and something new. Because for a while there wasn't really anything new that hadn't already been made. So I remember even when the Black Widow movie, they released it on TV, and which, they cheated a lot of people out of a lot of money by doing that. But we were just glued to it. It was seeing something new and something that felt normal. It was that it was that kind of normality. It was just really helpful. I wish they'd found a way to do it without cheating everybody involved with it. But that's corporations for you. But yeah, but so I think that the fact that they're making a podcast is very rooted in Only Murders in the Building is very rooted in its origins in the pandemic. And I haven't really read up on it about, the who can why they conceived it or and everything. But I want to say it sure feels like that was a big important part of it.
And there might be also something perhaps about the fact that they are everyday people, amateurs, solving what are usually crimes that policemen or professional sleuths are focused on. And there's a certain blurring that goes with it between the private and the public. Their lives get mixed in all of this. So I think that the internet and the podcast element brings something interesting about all this, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the fact that it does in those true crime podcasts, it's like there's a lot of are they harming, are they preventing people from actually solving these crimes, and people, particularly when people seize on suspects and it turns out and they turn out to be completely wrong, and that kind of thing, and they're persecuting someone over it. That kind of stuff. So I think that there's a lot of discussion there over that. And I think that's certainly it's an even more modern, interesting interpretation of the usual the thing in mysteries that's very common is having the amateur detective. And so this the podcast where the amateur detective actually has a way to get their theories out there to the public and kind of force the police to have to deal with them that they didn't have in the in earlier mysteries. So that makes it even more interesting, I think.
And it's such a mirror to life now in terms of, the fact that during the show you mentioned this interactive element that we, the viewers, can really participate in this investigation. And that's, it feels like those podcasts, also in reality, attract a lot of amateur sleuths who also feel like they're participating in a cold case or weighing in on different pieces of evidence and things like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I watched a documentary about one where they were, I'm not sure if they were making a podcast. I think they were making a documentary about a young man was making one about the murder of his mother, and which had never been really well investigated. And And it's really when you see all the evidence together, it seems really obvious, but it's like the there's still never been when anybody actually arrested for it. And those and so in a way they're kind of frustrating because you're looking at it going, I would like to see this on Dateline and watch them actually give me all the evidences. Why has the suspect not been arrested? Because it sure does look like. But we can only make the decisions on the information we're given.
To go back to what you were saying about true crime and their importance, it seems to me that there's a tension in on the murders in the building in the fact that it is dealing about something that is actually awful, which is crime, but doing this in a comedic fashion. What is your take on this?
Well, I think that they kind of reference that in especially in moments throughout the series, especially in the fourth season where they find out, the brothers' sisters put cameras all over the place and are filming them without telling them, even though they've agreed to it in their contract, which they didn't read. And I think, God, I can't remember who says it is. Some person said, "Well, you," Charles tells someone to turn the camera off. I said, "Well, you mine other people's pain for your own benefit in the podcast." And there's no real answer to that because, yeah, that's what they do. But that's sort of the history of mystery as a genre. I think Lucy Worsley has a really interesting documentary about that, about going back to the origins of mystery and how the idea of basically someone in your circle or family or whatever being killed in your house has become the cozy country house mystery. How weird that is. And of seeing, murder and crime as entertainment. And what that does it is it reassuring to us watching, because having these things, these mysteries solved is very satisfying and in some ways reassuring. And is it just something as humans we have to deal with because we are vulnerable and we have to, it's almost helpful to know about ways in which you're vulnerable and to see other people overcome things and to see other people survive. And that seems all wrapped up with the genre of mystery, which is really complex. And again, I think Only Murders in the Building does that really well as it's a mystery about mysteries. And part of and then the whole obsession with mysteries is really a core part of it.
And it's interesting too that so many people talk about horror and comedy being two sides of the same coin. And I feel like you
Oh,
really find
yeah.
that balance here, don't you, in the show and all
Yeah.
kind of comforting comedic conventions of the genre while being innovative at the same time. I say that because I really, really love the detective with whom they clash, but who kind of grows to love them anyway, despite
Yes.
they're interfering in her cases. That's Divine Joy Randolph, who's just fantastic as Detective Williams, I think.
Oh, she's brilliant. And I like how at first the first time you meet her, it's sort of like this is just the obstructive cop. And the more you get to know her, the more you like her and find out about her life. She's married, her wife has had a kid and they're trying to deal with this. And then you find out in the third season she's a big Broadway fan and knows all about musicals. And it's like you start to see why she kind of likes them because in a lot of what they have that thing in common. They're very it's because yeah, that's one of the core things of the show is very different people who have these things in common and find out they have more things in common. But yeah, she's also a fantastic actress.
I was thinking about the cozy mystery aspect of the film and how cozy mysteries, to a great extent, originated in England, which is strangely a very safe country. And I was w wondering if the fact that it takes place in New York is of importance. I mean, because New York, on many levels, is close to Europe and close to England. Do you think there might be a little something there about this?
I think it's a good setting for it because it's such a complex city, and it's viewed as being in some ways a dangerous city, even though really in modern times it really is not. I mean, crime has been dropping pretty much in most of the world at a fairly big rate, and there's different reasons for that. Or different people believe different that there's different reasons for that we that are pretty complicated to go into, but it get it does it is a traditional sort of stage for this kind of murder, and we're taking basically the country house murder and making it the upscale apartment condo building murder, which is and yeah, the whole thing of a country house is you have a bunch of different people staying there for whatever reason. And in the Arconia, we don't even have to worry about that. We have all the different potential for all the different people and their relationships and everything. And to be able to do something country houses usually can, just pull new people out of your little store of people you've got there. But also I think that it's also part of that conceit that if you really look at if this really happened, if someone was really if you really had like three or four people murdered in this building, people would be flowing out of it in waves. The cops would be camped out there. And that's sort of like any other popular mystery. Like we were talking once about Inspector Lewis. Where you have these, every episode they have three or four murders in like one department at Oxford, one college at Oxford. And if they happened in real life, everyone would just go absolutely nuts. People would leave, they would come get their kids, people would flee. If it happened at like I lived near Texas A&M University and I went there as a student. If anything, even approaching that one murder happened, the university would probably send everybody home if two had, I mean, it's just like the insurance won't cover this. It just does not happen. And I wonder how many people who see these shows and are not, I guess, into the mystery genre think it actually does happen. Because this kind of stuff does not happen. When it does, it's like they would call in the National Guard.
That reminds me that fans of Wallander, the thriller series, that they love to go to Sweden as tourists. And I heard that the small town in which this is set, that the locals are just absolutely horrified and so tired of the entire world thinking that they're some kind of crime haven.
Oxford, the capital
And it's like, yeah, I've been to Sweden and it's just not, I mean, when you're over there, you forget Wallander exists because it is just not like that. especially when you're there in the summer, it's like it would be hard to imagine something like that happening, especially stuff they come up with on Wallander. That's pretty extreme.
Have you by any chance seen the TV series The Man on the Inside?
No, I haven't seen that one. I've heard it's got Ted Danson, right? Yeah, I've heard it's really good.
I just feel like only Murders in the Building really paved the way for this series. It has a different tone, very different mood, but at the same time, there's something similar in that it's more about really discovering the dimensionality of older, mature characters and really giving them important screen time. So that's something nice to see. I think that might be an effect of only Murders in the Building.
Yeah, I wonder if that's the case. It sounds like it could be because one of the things, again, in cozy murders, the tradition of cozy murders is it feels like the victim has to be someone they don't like, that the viewer, the reader doesn't like in order to, make it cozy. And Only Murders in the Building does a thing where they don't just throw the victim away. As we find out about all our other characters, we're finding out about the victim too, and you start having more and more sympathy for that person. And they do that every time. And I think that's almost a more like a modern reconfiguration of the cozy murder. It still feels cozy because you still like your characters and your main characters, and you're still following through their viewpoint and everything, but you're also feeling sympathy towards the victim, which is a really better thing to do. Having murders where you're callous about the victim, that's not really good for our society as a whole, or people as individuals. And so it does feel, I think that's one reason why it does feel so cozy, because we're not ignoring things like grief and anger and all that, but we're expressing them. We're seeing them expressed and as normal, natural part of this. It kind of reminds me a little bit of what Broadchurch did with showing how one murder almost destroys this entire town, and how it the real consequences of it and how many people are affected by it, and it just sort of radiates outward and keeps going and going. It's with each season they're still dealing with the fallout of this one person's act. And Only Murders in the Building takes a different tack of that, since it is kind of designed to comfort people and make you laugh, but that's kind of relates back to being a pandemic story originally, because terrible things were happening, but you still had to exist and you had to cope, and being able to laugh, being able to be comforted was an important part of that.
Even laughing in the face of death.
The times when the characters really think they're going to die, the bad guy's going to kill them, and there's the moment we think Charles has been killed, and you're kind of sitting there going, I don't believe this is happening. Oh gosh, I really hope not. Maybe they'll do it. I don't know, because it was only the second season at that point. In the end of the fourth season, where we see who was murdered, they kept sort of teasing you with the idea, well, it's going to be Loretta, and so you're going back and forth going, is it? I hope not. Are they going to kill Meryl Streep? Oh my God. Are they really going to do that? And then they don't. You're like, oh, okay. And yeah, that moment when you think it's not going to happen this time, because it's been a little different every time, and then suddenly it's you see who it is, and it's like, ah. So it's I think that's part of, I guess that's one of the reasons why it does feel comforting, even though it's a cozy mystery. It's like it's a compassionate cozy mystery. It's not, yeah, that's the word I've been looking for. It's compassionate rather than drawing the humor out of, oh, this was a bad person, they deserve to die. Nobody's callous. It's like even people who are callous, it's like they're doing it. It just feels like they're doing it for their own reasons. It's like you have so much understanding of people as it goes deeper and deeper, that I don't know, it just, again, it feels like it's you feel safe while you're watching it, like they're not really going to do anything that you can't, show you anything you can't take.
And you mentioned Broadchurch and Lewis, and I've got the feeling that British people are very good at those compassionate mysteries. Are you watching other shows coming from the United Kingdom or elsewhere?
Oh yeah, British mysteries are super popular in the US, and a lot of that is when, before cable really got, and before streaming and everything, you saw a lot of those on PBS. And so they got really popular on PBS originally, and now they've spread out and all these different places have them, and so we're seeing a lot more of them. And now we've got streaming, BritBox and Acorn are the two big British streaming services, and you can see a lot of them on that. You can also see a lot of European ones, and so we're starting to see ones that subtitled a lot of French and Nordic noir and all that kind that and there was even a, I can't remember the name of it. It was a funny mystery, but had a but it was actually a really good mystery, and it was making fun of all the other different Nordic noir mysteries. And gosh, I wish I could remember the name, but they so many things.
Is it
Was
perhaps
like,
Lillehammer?
no, there was it was like Falda or something.
Oh, we'll have to look for that. It
Yes.
sounds right. Yeah, I can't remember the name. And then the Australian one. I can't remember. What was the name of it? Anyway, it was Australian, and it was set with it was a lot of female characters. It was set in a little town on the coast with that was trying to become a resort and had at some point become a haven for lesbians, and they were trying to have an art festival while these horribly murdered corpses are showing up on the beach, and it had the and it was kind of in a way it's making it's very funny and it's making fun of other mysteries, but it's also an actually good mystery. And I love that that's coming in that because I've tried to watch some the older shows that were just making fun of mysteries. And it's sort of not, it's like it's that's it sort of feels like a one note joke. An actual comedy mystery still has to be not only just a comedy, but also a really good mystery.
That's right. We've spoken a lot today about the characters and the character development in the writing for Only Murders in the Building. And I was curious because most of the work that I know from you is fantasy or science fiction in the speculative fiction genre. But I have the feeling that there are really strong parallels in terms of you developing these incredibly complex characters. And I'm just wondering, within genres where world building is so important, where moving the adventure along, because there is much adventuring in your work too, I'm wondering how do you find that balance as a writer? How do you approach the question of characters versus plot development and how they're intertwined?
Well, I don't think when you, I don't think you can ever sacrifice character for plot development. It's like you can't sacrifice character for humor. Like I think it's called Carl Reiner had a quote where you can't make up stuff for a joke. Basically, it's like the humor has to come from who the people are. It has to be a real part of the story. It has to be drawn from that, or it's just not going to work. And so I think that's a big part of it is your story and your plot should come out of your characters because your people are what's moving things along. There's all their decisions. And every decision that the characters make is part of their characterization. They have to be the kind of people who will make that decision that will then move your plot in the direction you want it to go. So that's I just don't feel like to me as a reader and a storyteller, plot's not that important to me. It's what the characters feel about what's going on.
And your most famous character, I suppose, is Murderbot, possibly. Can you tell us about Murderbot and about what's coming soon, hopefully, on television concerning Murderbot?
Yeah, that's been really exciting because that doesn't having a lot of science fiction fantasy gets optioned, I think, and usually those options by for TV or movies, and they're usually not very much money either because it's just basically a studio buying the right to maybe think about making it a movie or TV, and so to actually not only have an option, but have it actually go all the way to getting made and going to come out. That's like finding a unicorn. It does not happen very much. So I'm still kind of in, I know we've been talking about it and working about on it since 2021. So I still am slightly in shock that it's actually going to be out this year, and I'm incredibly excited about it. And I think they've done something. They've taken it, and it feels like my book, but it also feels like something really cool and new for TV, in the way they've done it. And it's really true to the book, even when they've had to add parts to make it longer and fit into the 10 episodes. So yeah, I'm really excited for people to see it. I've been waiting a long time for people to, for a long time we couldn't talk about it. I don't think we were able to talk about it until Apple released a press release. I think that was not this previous December, but the December before then was the first time we were allowed to actually say, even say it had been optioned. I think I could say it had been optioned, but I can say anything else.
I only barely
So,
asked
yeah.
about it because I recently heard Alexander Skarsgård talk about the series a little bit, and I thought, okay, I can ask her.
Yeah. It's like all the, there's several articles in Deadline that give, you know, the cast, talk about the casting and stuff that so really that's all I can only say what they've already released. But once it comes out, I think we'll be able to talk a lot more about it, and I can post my pictures from the set and stuff like that. So
And do we have a date yet for the release? Do we know when it's coming?
I can't say when it's coming. It's gonna be this year.
Okay, great. So we don't have to wait too long.
No, you don't. So
And can you perhaps tell our listeners a little bit about who Murderbot is?
Murderbot is it's a set in a very far future world where Murderbot is a construct that's basically been created to be a security unit. And they're basically enslaved to this one corporation that rents them out. And there are other corporations that make them, but this is Murderbot is from this particular one. And it has a governor module that keeps it under control. And it's that's how they keep their security units under control. And it's been able to hack its governor module, which gives it, you know, the free will, basically. But it's not sure what to do. There's not really a lot of places where it can go. And so it's just basically been doing its job, pretending to still be under control, watching entertainment media that it can now download and kind of goofing off a lot to do that. And it ends up having to reveal that it has free will in order to save the people that it's been charged with protecting. And so it's a lot. It was written before the pandemic, but it has a lot of that. I just want to retire from reality and just watch or entertain, watch TV or read that I was feeling at the time. So
It was definitely my pandemic comfort read. That's when I came to Murderbot and I went through them all consecutively. I just gobbled them and it was so comforting.
But talking about the comfort aspect, I think there's actually a link there between Murderbot and Only Murders in the Building. I think that those are two very compassionate works, and also two works that, even though they deal with something serious, a murder or war, are also very funny. I mean, there's a lot of humor in Murderbot too, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. And it's character-driven humor because that's what I really like the best. And it's sort of that, a lot of it's that kind of really bitter, the bitter humor, sarcastic humor that comes when you're dealing with something really bad. And that's what that's kind of my kind of humor. So it's the I am a very sarcastic person, and I think it shows in the books. But yeah, and that's something in Only Murders in the Building too. Mabel in particular is really is that kind of person of, you know, I'm going to deal with these, you know, with these terrible things that happen with this sarcastic humor. And so I do think it's not surprising. It's one of my favorite shows.
And you've written a lot of, well, not a lot, but you've written several media tie-in novels. Do you think you would ever write an Only Murders in the Building mystery?
No, because I enjoy it too much. I wouldn't want that to be my work, basically, because it would take a lot of work. It's hard to write a good complex mystery. The first one, genres combine a lot. So a lot of science fiction and fantasy has mystery elements the way it has romance elements. My first one I did that with was The Death of the Necromancer, which has a which is a fantasy, but it's already it's wrapped around a mystery that the characters are trying to solve. And it's really hard. It's not easy to do that, especially to make a complex one that people don't figure out.
And are you currently working on something special?
A new
I'm working on the next Murderbot
Mm-hmm.
novella, and because there's going to be this one and then one more, which I haven't written yet. I just finished Queen Demon, which is the sequel to Witch King, which is the fantasy series I'm working on now. So after I finish this novella, the Murderbot novella, I'm going to go back and write another the third book in the Witch King. I guess it's going to be a trilogy. And then I'll go back and work on the last Murderbot.
That's so exciting. So, should we look for the next Murderbot installment in a year or two? Does that sound right?
I don't remember when they're going to put it out. There was a schedule, but again, everything got thrown off. I had breast cancer a couple of years ago, and so that really slowed me down. And so we've kind of been winging it since then on the publisher schedule of what they wanted to do. So I can't remember now if it's going to be out this year or next year. But Queen Demon got moved. Queen Demon's coming out in October.
Oh, great.
So, and actually I have a revised reprint of two of my earlier young adult novels, Emily in the Hollow World and Emily in the Sky World, which is coming out in May, and then Queen Demon in October. And then I'm not sure. I'm assuming the Murderbot won't be out until a few months after that.
Well, that's exciting. We've got a whole chain of new publications to look out for. That's great.
Well, thank you.
Can you give us an idea of how long it takes you to write one of those stories of Murderbot or any other series?
Well, for the novella, the first one, All Systems Red, only took me a month. But after that, the novellas took me about 3 to 4 months. And because I end up doing a lot of writing on Murderbot, that then I end up sometimes in a 35,000 word novella, I'll write 20,000 words and ended up throwing most of it out and starting again. With the novel, the longer novel, Network Effect, it probably took me a year and a half to write, and I normally can write a novel in a year, but Network Effect took longer, probably because I wrote probably most of that first year was writing the first 50,000 words, just because I was continually starting and then restarting and taking stuff out and really finding the shape of the story. And Murderbot's just very complex in the fact that it has all these different abilities that you always have to account for in all your plots, and you have to, and it has this point, be able to have points of view and see what other different points of view and see what other characters are doing and everything. So it makes, especially like the fight scenes and the action scenes, very complicated. So that's one reason it takes a long time. And it just takes me basically a long time to conceptualize it. And I have a lot of difficulty conceptualizing these action scenes until I write them. So then I'll write stuff and then end up having to throw it out because it won't work. So it just goes very slowly. And I'm a little bit faster with fantasy, but not that much faster.
It's really interesting to hear about all of this writing that goes into the process, but then never really sees the light of day, so to speak. Do you think that some of that work will eventually potentially become short story material or might ever be released, or you prefer to have it just be part of the process and not enter into the canon?
It's generally part of the process. It doesn't, I mean, very rarely does something actually is coherent enough to actually be pulled out and be like a story on its own or something, because a lot of it is just stuff that doesn't work for the character or the environment. It's not like I write a different story. It's just like this is not developing.
Mm, okay.
So it's just not good. So yeah, it doesn't, and most of it, I think it ends up just getting deleted out of the file as I'm writing, as I when I finally start actually going in the right direction.
Right. But it's very much a necessary process in your writing practice.
Would you say that erasing is somehow as important as writing?
Yeah, definitely. Because it's like you can usually when you kind of write yourself into a corner where you realize what I'm doing with the characters here is just not working, it's because you've not set it up earlier. And or possibly you've started the story in the wrong place and it needs to either be further back or further ahead. So there's just a lot of that ends up with being a lot of stuff that just gets thrown out. And it's like, and usually I'll go through and like I'll find one or two lines I really like and save them. And sometimes with a fantasy novel, one time I had a really cute little scene that was only like a couple of sentences long with these mushroom people. And I think I looked all over the book for a place to put the mushroom people and it just didn't fit in anywhere. And it just, everywhere I put it, it was just like, it's just stopping the story there. And so it ended up having to go wait a couple of books later and it went in. But yeah, so it's just stuff that doesn't, that has to do with it's not working for the pacing, it's not working for the tone or the mood, and it just gets tossed out.
Fantastic. Well, we really appreciate the time that we've spent with you. And we usually like to close by asking, is there something you wish that we had asked you today during the podcast?
I think we had a really good conversation. So if it is, I can't remember it now. But I really enjoyed talking about it's really nice to be able to talk about a show like this in a lot of serious detail, because you normally don't see that.
You don't intellectualize it necessarily when you watch it, do you? Or not the same way.
And it's really until you're talking about it and breaking it down with other people that you really start to realize all these things about it.
Oh. Well, I was so excited when you agreed to come on the podcast, and then even further excited to hear that you're a fan of Only Murders in the Building. So thank you so much. It really made my day today to speak with you.
It was wonderful to speak with you, and it was a great pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.